Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inner Voice Intuitive Hour with your host, Jenny Seek.
Hi, folks. This is Jenny Seek, and this is your weekly forum for connecting with your intuitive process, all things metaphysical, and honoring and recognizing your soul self. Thanks for tuning in, and enjoy the ride.
Hi there, everybody. This is your host, Jenny Seek, and this is a forum for folks who are interested in the cross-section between depth psychology and looking at the unconscious and looking at our unconscious patterns, bringing them to the surface and becoming more aware of who we are on a soulful level and how that intersects with the metaphysical, how that intersects with our connection with the intuitive realms and how we connect and tap into those intuitive realms for ourselves so that we can be our best self and our most aware and most refined self when we show up in the world and can work to create a better world. So thanks so much for listening to Inner Voice Intuitive Hour. I want to share with you real briefly what is coming up. We have a pretty exciting summer here. Next week, I am still trying to figure out what to do, and hopefully Spirit will tell me and I will be led in the right direction. July 10th, Tony Gilbert will be on. Tony Gilbert is a depth psychology tarot reader, and she does a lot of work with archetypes. I just finished her wonderful book, Messages from the Archetypes, Using Tarot for Healing and Spiritual Growth. So she's going to talk about how she uses tarot, not so much for divination, but more to connect people with a message of healing inside themselves and to give them inner guidance. And her process is a little different. It's a little more like sitting with the client and letting them see what they see in the card. So I'm really excited to have her on the show on July 10th. And then on July 24th, C. Michael Smith will be on. C. Michael Smith is a depth psychologist and also a shaman, and he has a wonderful location up in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and it's called the Crow's Nest, and I'm actually really excited because me and my partner are going to go up there and check out his digs, but I'm really excited to have him on the show. I'm reading his book, Psychotherapy and the Sacred, which is proving to be a really, really wonderful read, and so he will be on with us on July 24th. Then on July 31st, Samantha Heron will be on. Samantha Heron is part of the Pagan community, and she also does archetypal and astrological readings. So I'm really excited to have her on as well. And then Christiana Claudette, and you can find all these people on Facebook. They all have Facebook pages. Christiana Claudette will be on August 7th, and she will be sharing her wisdom with the tarot. And you can look her up on Facebook as well as Samantha Heron and C. Michael Smith and the Crow's Nest. So I hope that you can listen to some of that programming in the future. And then with no further ado, tonight I have Michael O'Malley on. Michael O'Malley is a sacred storyteller. I've been lucky enough to be able to hear some of the wonderful stories that he tells, and I just love the way that he uses sacred celebrations and to draw on different themes, and also how he pulls community together. So I'm so excited to have him on tonight. Are you there, Michael?
I am. Thank you, Jenny. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks so much for accepting the invitation this evening.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, the first thing I usually ask folks when they're on the show is, this is a different kind of a career than a lot of people choose or have chosen for them, and I'm wondering how you came to consider sacred storytelling part of your calling, and did it find you, or did you kind of bump into it and find it?
Wow, there's 17 answers to the question, right?
Sure.
but yeah, let me just see what pops up in terms of different ways that I do answer that question. I was an elementary school teacher, And so I did, I had seen when I first was going through my internship as an educator, I had seen some other teachers use storytelling in the classroom, and that encouraged me to do the same. And I also did, you know, a lot of story reading aloud in the classroom. I taught grades first, second, third, and fourth. So some of that was you know, that was certainly part of the influence. Going back a little further, before I was a teacher, I'm from Ohio originally, and I'm in Columbus, Ohio now, but I lived for a time in New England. And when I was in Boston, they have a first night celebration on New Year's Eve. And I was there with a bunch of buddies, and we were looking at different possibilities. And, you know, go see a klezmer band here, and there's the Chinese dragon in the parade, and, you know, puppeteers, and there's a huge ice sculpture. And you could pick different things for each hour. And at some point, we saw a storyteller. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I don't know what that is, but let's go check it out. And we ended up in this little theater space. I don't know the name of the particular theater, but a little theater space. There's mostly adults in the audience. But we arrived there, and there were maybe three or four of us there, and we couldn't find a seat. You know, the program hadn't started yet, and we were just about to walk out. And I saw a small sign that said balcony. And I've oftentimes said I'm very glad that I saw that sign. And I saw this sign that said balcony. We went up these, you know, narrow winding stairs, and then we were up there in the balcony. We found a few seats in the next to last row, and we looked down upon the stage. And, of course, I had seen plays before, but with a play you usually have, typically you have a set with, you know, whether it's a forest scene or the living room, but there was no set. There was a stool. And a few minutes later, an older man walked out on stage with white hair, white beard. His name's Gio Callahan. I've since met him a few times. And he walked out on the stage, and I will never forget the first word that I heard Jay utter, because the first thing he said was, "Raspberries!" And for the next hour, he told us this story that had something to do with raspberries. But in the course of all that, he was a young girl. He was a young man. He was a thief. He was the narrator. And at times we were all laughing together. At times I felt a lump rising in my throat. And at the end of that, I think it was probably about an hour-long program, I found myself looking down on that stage and thinking, wow, I wouldn't mind doing that myself someday. So certainly, you know, that's part of it, is that, you know, that magic of imagination. There is something that happens, and this isn't just, you know, professional storytelling or performing from a stage, but this can happen, you know, around the kitchen table with a friend or with a relative, or, you know, over dinner this happens, where we are transported through the story itself. And we end up with some sort of shared imagining that happens. And this is also, you know, nebulous and untouchable and important and beautiful and sacred. And so I feel very fortunate to be able to do this work.
Awesome. Awesome. I think too, you touched on that whole idea about how stories, I think that you're implying, you know, that stories can change you, you know, that the way someone turns a phrase or the way someone uses a symbol can evoke meaning in the listener, and it can evoke meaning in so many different ways to so many different listeners, like your, you know, illustration of the raspberry story, and just how healing it can be, and how sometimes in our culture we don't have these healing modalities in place that allow us to play in our imagination, or allow us to imagine ourselves being somewhere else or something else, which is actually the way we walk through the door to become who we will be, you know?
Absolutely. And you know, every time I tell a story, at one level, we're sharing, there's this shared experience. And at another level, there's something else that's happening. That I'll say there's N plus one stories, so that N being the number of people in the audience. So if there's seven people or 700 people in the audience, there's N plus one, because there is a story for each person, their experience of it, and the teller herself or himself is having an experience. So I might share a story, and it might bring up for you, you know, I might tell a story about, you know, my second grade teacher, and for you that might bring up some memories of, you know, your Aunt Betty that you haven't thought of in, you know, weeks or months or perhaps even years, and, you know, different scenarios unfold, and we're made of story, right? I mean, the stories we choose to tell, it is important. It's important what stories we choose to listen to, and it's important what stories we choose to tell. And it does open up things in ways that we don't understand. You know, one of the things I recently finished writing a book of 100 meditations, and I do a lot of work in with Buddhism, and I really do a blending of Buddhism, Christianity, and Mother Earth spirituality. We've been, for the last 3 years, we've had a home church that we call the Buddhist Christian Mother Church. And along with that, my storytelling has been a big part of that, and I've integrated all that into this book of 108 meditations that I call Shut Down the Computer, The Reappreciation of Storytelling in Everyday Life. And in each of those meditations, I'm exploring different facets of what storytelling is, what's the role of story listening in our lives. You know, as you mentioned, the different stories that we tell. If you sit down and meet someone, you might say, here, I'm going to tell this person about myself, and you might talk for 15 minutes or for an hour or even 2 hours, and how representative are those stories of who you are? Because we are so vast. There are so many stories that we could choose from that make up who we are. You know, so that's just one facet of, I think, looking at story in that way. And when you speak of the healing as well, I think of I do a lot of work with the teachings of the Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, and he speaks a lot of what seeds are we watering in ourselves. And so I pay real attention to what seeds I water in myself, and also as a father, what seeds, you know, we're watering in our children, what seeds are we allowing the media to water in our children, et cetera.
Yeah. Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's awesome. And I know that you do a lot of work, Michael, going into the classroom and sharing stories with students, younger mm-hmm. students. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that and how that plays into your whole idea of stories as healing and stories as helping communities to develop and grow and that sort of thing?
I have done my primary work over the years has been in schools, and I've done programs mm-hmm. anywhere from you know, daycare centers all the way up to colleges.
Awesome.
But certainly the majority of my work has been at the elementary school level. And it's amazing when you're telling stories with, you know, four, five, six, seven-year-olds. It's you know, when I'm telling a story, I want to go all the way into the tale. I want to become the characters that you see. And I'll even tell the students, I'll say, you know, how many of you forgot you were in a classroom? How many of you forgot you were in the school cafeteria? And the hands shoot up, right? Because we enter the story together. The same thing happens with adults, which is really, really awesome. But with young folks, you have to be careful because it is so real for them, you know, especially when you're looking at those 5-6-year-olds. So, you know, I recognize that this is it's important work, right? I mean, every culture, you know, whether your people come from, you know, Asia, Africa, Europe, the indigenous people of this continent or Australia or any of the island peoples, the Middle East, we are all descendants of storytellers. And the stories have always been part of, you know, you mentioned one of your future guests who describes himself as a shaman, and that shamanic element, part of that is the storyteller, right? The one who
yeah.
who the tribal person who shares the tales and is using story to help guide. Guide the community and the next generation. So that's all inherent in that. And you know, so there's so many layers and levels to this. So, you know, at one level, I can say, well, I'm creating excitement about books and about reading, and I certainly am, right? So principals will say, you know, the focus of my school's literacy, Michael, I want to have you here. You know, when you do that family night program, you're encouraging families to share their stories with each other. When you share those folk tales or stories from books or family tales, you're creating that excitement about stories. And I always tell the children, I'll say, you know, where I found that story? I found it in a book. I'll sometimes say, you know, of course, libraries have changed since my youth, but, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but, you know, the librarians who are always hushing us in the libraries, you know, I understand that. That's such a sacred place. You know, you should have a sense of reverence when you're there because each of those books holds story. And you know, that again, that touches upon another aspect of, you know, why I do what I do. We were talking, we had a couple of minutes to speak before the show, and I do stories from my ethnic heritage. My ethnic heritage is Irish American and Slovak American, and I've always felt a real connection to that. It was my four great-grandparents who came over from Ireland on my dad's side, and my grandparents who came over from Czechoslovakia on my mom's side. And so I tell Irish and Slovak stories. Well, you know, when I'm telling a story, I tell, for example, a story of the Seal people, the Silky. And when I'm telling this story that was recorded in 1892, you know, I'm thinking about how that's connected to the past. You know, one of my meditations is entitled, in my book, is entitled "Conspiring with the Ancestors." That's what I do. Caitlin and John Matthews have written a lot on Celtic spirituality, and she speaks of conspiring with the descendants. And I took that, and of course, we do need to conspire with our descendants. We need to be looking toward the future generations, but we're simultaneously conspiring with the ancestors. You know, and I'm doing that with you when I share a family story. You know, I'm conspiring with my ancestors, whether they're still present, manifesting in this form or not. I'm conspiring with them. But the last word I'd like to say in terms of, not necessarily the last word on this, you ask a storyteller a question, you got to be careful, Jenny. You might not get to ask me another question. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, just outside of Youngstown, a blue collar community in the small town of Struthers, Ohio. And I've had an opportunity to share stories in my hometown many, many, many times over the years. And I've realized that, you know, I've been the hometown storyteller. And a couple of years ago, I was visiting the Struthers Elementary School, the K-4 building. And I usually visit in the fall, but then sometimes I'll come back and just kind of check in with them in the spring. And in the spring, I was there with these fourth graders, and I started to ask them, you know, see what questions they had for me, and I was asking them questions. But then I started asking them, hey, who remembers one of the stories? And they start raising their hands. Oh yeah, you told us that one story about the scarecrow out in the field, and oh yeah, and you told us that Slovak story about that one guy who turned into this huge fish, and oh yeah, you have that great story about your dog that could sneeze on command, and I had shared with them hours and hours of story from kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth grade. And so here are these children who are growing up in the town that I grew up in, and I have had an opportunity to share. I can't remember the exact numbers. I actually figured it out I don't know if it was 12 or 14 hours worth of story with them mm-hmm. over the years. And I have about 50 hours, maybe 60 hours worth of story in my repertoire. But it's like, so a bit of me is in them, right? A bit
sure.
of my story is now a part of them. And every time we do that, every time you sit down with a friend and you listen with compassion or you share from the heart, whether it's a story from your life, whether it's a story about something that's touched you or moved you, a book that you're reading, we're actually pieces of us go into each other. And that's we can't know each other if we don't know each other's stories.
Well, and just the fact that we're modeling for each other the importance of storytelling means that perhaps those children have tools in their repertoire to construct or reframe their experiences in life and focus on what you're talking about, you know, feeding the positive, feeding the stories that really inspire themselves, as opposed to the stories that maybe the media tells them or heavier stories that don't offer such illumination, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we look at, to draw from the ancestors again, my grandfathers, I happen to be the youngest child of the youngest child on the Slovak side of Slovak immigrants, and I'm the youngest child of the youngest child of the youngest child of Irish immigrants. And so I have this certain perspective. You know, all my grandparents were born in the 1800s. My two grandfathers died in 1929 and 1931. And and I sometimes think, what would they think if they saw the kinds of stories that our young people and our children are bombarded with, you know, just continuously exposed to? And you know, if you look, I mean, there's a reason why the title of my book is Shut Down the Computer. I mean, I could have, you know, I years ago I had the I had the bumper sticker, you know, kill your television, because I would see the stuff that was coming through the TV. And, you know, studies are showing now the number of hours that that children are in front of a screen per day.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. It's nearly every waking hour. I forget the exact statistics off the top of my head, but nearly every waking hour outside of school, children are in front of a screen. And I was outside. Actually, we were up visiting my mom in Northeast Ohio, and my three children, going into seventh grade, fifth grade, and kindergarten. We were in Mrs. Brown's yard next door. Mrs. Brown, you know, I was born in 62. My mom still lives in the same house, and Mrs. Brown was living there before my mom moved in, right? So this is the old neighborhood, right? And so we're in Mrs. Brown's front yard, and the kids are we were catching lightning bugs outside, and then they were rolling down the hill and just having a blast. And I looked around, and I realized there's no other children. There are no children out here. And if you walk or drive through most communities in our country, you won't see the children because they're not there. They're not outside. They're not in nature. And, you know, if you think of the importance of story, my gosh, the stories that I have of, you know, and they're not all happy stories, right? I mean, we weren't always kind to each other, but there was a richness, and there was a lot that was kind and a lot that was lovely, but there was this richness of story that we were living in, you know, and it was a blue collar suburb where we're running through the backyards and playing and, you know, kickball games and kick the can and going down to the, you know, the corner store and all that. And what happens when our children just sit in front of a screen, and even if it's not necessarily watering negative seeds in them, and I'd say most of these programs are, I mean, they're just sitting there. And some of those programs can be pretty creative and pretty imaginative, but what about the children's imagination? You know, whose imagination?
Right.
One of my meditations is titled "Whose Imagination Is It?" You know, because
right.
because they're plugging into somebody else's, you know, video game world rather than their own imaginings.
Yes, exactly. Well, and also what you're talking about is, you know, they're not connected to a connection with their body when they're not in nature and they're just sitting there and being recipients of this information. They're not embodied, and when they're not embodied and having an experience of going out into nature and, you know, rolling down hills and actually engaging with the world, they're first of all receptacles for just information and not able to say, I think, to a certain extent, not able to say no, or I don't like that, or I would prefer this. They're not able to shape that information for themselves, so that they're less intuitive and less in their imagination and more just receiving whatever comes at them and just, you know, that sort of thing.
Right, it becomes something very, very passive, and one of the things that I do, particularly with young children when I'm doing storytelling, is there's a lot of one is the stories I'm selecting. I'm picking stories that, you know, some of them will have a message to them. Others are just, you know, they're just fun, or they're just, you know, there's just a richness to them. But I'm certainly trying to water good seeds in them and water worthy seeds in them. And I'm constantly inviting them to be participants in the story, to be doing little movements in the story, because as you're saying, we are, and children are, kinesthetic learners, right? They learn through that movement. They learn through that experience. And, yeah, what happens when we're missing out on all that? So certainly, yeah, I just think it's so important that we expose ourselves to worthy story, and that we look at what are the stories that are going into us, but also what are the stories that we're experiencing, that we're leaning into, that we're living out. You know, one of the things that I look at all the time as a father of four is I try to remember what are some of the really great things from my childhood that I want to offer to our kiddos. You know, I love sled riding, you know. So, you know, we had very little snow in Columbus this past winter, but fortunately, with rides up to friends in Cleveland and Northeast Ohio to visit my mom, you know, we managed to get on the sleds, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 times this past winter, because it's important. You know, it's important to just get out there and have that fun and have those experiences, because when you have that richness of experience, what you're doing is that's the stuff that the stories you later tell are made of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What you're doing on later. Sure. I want to make sure that you have time to talk about your book. I was so delighted to get to hold your book. It's so exciting. I'm working on a book myself, and it's so exciting to see the end product of someone's, you know, someone's hard work and someone's envisioning and someone's creativity. And it was just so neat to get to hold your book when it was just completed. And I got to look through it a tiny bit and love the storytelling pieces, love the meditation pieces, but also love the underpinnings about, you know, archetypally what these stories are about, what these themes are about, what they say about community and what they say about us all being on the planet together. And this sort of, you had this great deep awareness of the importance of the meditations that you were using. And it was so multi-layered, and I just loved it. So I want to get you to get a chance to talk more about how the book came together and how the different parts of the book came together.
Sure. You know, going back quite a few years, we did with 3 or 4 buddies, we had a little men's retreat weekend several years ago. And on that weekend, I happened to bring down some of my writing. And I decided, well, you know, share something with these guys, you know, I'm sometimes hesitant to share what I write, but I thought, well, I'll share something with them. And they were really receptive. And one of the guys asked me, he said, he said, Michael, who reads this stuff? And I'm afraid this sounds a little too precious as I tell you this story, but this is the honest response. That question had never occurred to me.
Okay.
I just write. I just write. That's what I do, right? That's part of what I do. Ruth Sawyer wrote a lovely book in 1942 called The Way of the Storyteller. And in that, she says, the most important practice for the storyteller is the building of spiritual background. And I took her at her word. And I've always, since I started the storytelling work in 1995, I've seen it as part of my spiritual practice, both when I'm telling, but also all the prep I do for telling, all the writing that I do in terms of reflecting on, society and story and all these other things, as well as, my blending of the different spiritual traditions that are a part of my life. And so I write, and I write, and I write. And so I guess we started to think a little bit more about that question, like who does read this stuff? And a few years ago, I put out a picture book. It's a book CD set, Tom Moore and the Seal Woman, an Irish tale. And those are that's a story that I'll share with an adult audience or with children. But still, there's all this mulling about the kind of things that you and I have been talking about here for the first half of this program that I'm constantly in dialogue with people about and constantly musing on and constantly writing about. And so I decided that I wanted to put these ideas and thoughts, at least some of them, together in a book form. And it talked about it for years and years and years and years. And then kind of came to this, the reappreciation. One was shutting down the computer because I'm part Luddite. I mean, I recognize the value of technology. I've had surgery a couple of times in the last 3 years. I'm grateful for technology in so many respects. But I have a very cautious eye towards the role of technology in our lives, and I want to continue to be very discerning in my use of technology because I think it's taken a lot from us. And I didn't want it to be just complaining about technology. We all are, maybe not all of us, but people certainly are questioning that. But the reappreciation of storytelling and everyday life, because I think where I'm sitting right now, I'm actually in my niece's home as I'm sitting here, and I can look out the window and I can see, I'm looking and I can see the leaves that are further back in the tree and the way they're moving in the sunlight. And, when I came by earlier today, there was a chipmunk that ran across the driveway. And, as I mentioned last night, I was out there with the lightning bugs. And I said, kiddos, I'm going to just count how many I see. I couldn't count that fast. I said, there must be 1,000 lightning bugs between my mom's backyard and Mrs. Brown's backyard. These little bugs that come from where? They just come crawling up out of the grass and then they illuminate they illuminate the dusk sky. And this is what we live in if we choose to see it. This is the reality. We're on this ball spinning in space. We have this, we can share stories. I can grab a story from the 1800s because we have this thing called print, and we have this ability called reading, where I can take a story from people who are no longer here in this form, and I can bring that story back to life. There is just so much about this life and this world that is awe-inspiring, and I wanted to create someplace to share that, and so that's where this book comes from. And in writing the book and trying to think about ways of looking at it, the one section I came up with was what is storytelling and what is not storytelling, because oftentimes I tell people I'm a storyteller and they look at me like, what does that mean? it's funny though, when I was in Ireland, I was visiting Ireland doing some research on my stories a few years ago, and I would tell people there I was a storyteller and they seemed to understand.
Right,
they're a little closer to the tradition. So, oh, you're there, right? Hello?
I'm sorry? Yeah.
Oh, I just want to make sure. I was, it sounded like I had a disconnect on this line. But I was doing a program at a school a few years ago, and I was there for a full week. I was doing an artist in residency there, and I was setting up chairs in the cafeteria. I think it was a Wednesday, and a little boy walks through. He's delivering the lunch money down to the cafeteria ladies, and he had actually already been at my program on Tuesday. So when he walks through and sees me setting up the chairs, he understands what I'm doing. So he walks by, he delivers the money to the lunch ladies, he walks back and he stops. And he looks and he says, "The story space is ready." Uh-huh. And it was such a wonderful line, "The story space is ready." So in my book, I have a number of sections, and one of them is "The story space is ready, our modern world." So despite all the obstacles and barriers and limitations, we can create space for real storytelling, for deep, compassionate story listening in this modern world. And then, so I have a number of meditations under that. And then I have another section, "The story space is ready, our personal and home environment." So, you know, in that section, one of the meditations is entitled "The Family Dinner Table, a Thing of the Future." Because in our household, we have almost every meal is a family meal. That's a choice we're making. And another one in that section is "Lights Out Sunday Nights." A few years ago, the hurricane force winds came through Ohio and they knocked out the electricity. I don't know if you were in Ohio at that time or not, Jenny.
I remember.
The hurricane force winds were knocked out. I was actually on my way to West Virginia. I was doing a week of programming at a school at some schools down in West Virginia. And I'm staying at a motel down there, and I talk to my wife, and she, you know, there's 2 or 3 or 4 days with no electricity, and she was really upset. And she was really upset because I was in West Virginia, and I was missing out on all the fun.
Because were doing different things when the lights were out.
Exactly, because life slows down.
Yes.
Life slows down. She was, you know, playing board games with the kiddos by candlelight, reading to them by candlelight, visiting more with neighbors and friends. She was so bummed out that I was missing out on all the fun. And there I was in, you know, the corporate confines with my indoor pool and 100 channels on the cable and 0 friends, right? No one there with me. Now, the work I was doing, I was really enjoying that. But then I'd come back, and it was this stale, cold space. And so what we did was we started Lights Out Sunday Nights. We also call them Hurricane Sundays. And so those are nights where we'll do it. We don't do it every Sunday. We probably do it 2 or 3 times a month if it works out for us. So we'll have as on those days when it starts to get dark outside, we don't put on the lights. We don't put on the radio. We don't put on the television. We don't put on the computer. You know, we don't turn on the computer. We have candlelight. The story space is ready. And a friend of mine pointed out. He said, "Michael, think about that environmentally. Think about the impact that would have if everyone did a practice of Lights Out Sunday Nights in the United States of America, or if 10% of the people did it, or 20%. I wasn't even thinking of it in terms of Earth stewardship, which is very important to me. I was just doing it, or we were doing it, or we are doing it for the deep joy of it. And this life is sacred. And we need to resacralize our world. We need to remythologize our lives. And we need to create the space for story." And so, you know, I don't own a cell phone. That is a choice. You know, it is. And a lot of these things, they don't feel like they are choices, but I think we have a lot more choice than we recognize. Of course, there's limitations. You know, I have one buddy. He doesn't own a car. He never has. And I applaud him. He raised a family and has had this vibrant life without a car. Now, I have a car. I want to come up and visit my mom, you know, 3 hours away. And so we all have to decide what we want to do and what we don't want to do. But the point is we're deciding.
I think, too, when we get into that place of silence with ourselves and we get into that place of decision about how it is we want to live our lives and the choices we want to make, there's this undercurrent of knowing that for us, in some ways it's a choice, but in some ways it's a sacred act to act in the world the way that we need to. So there becomes an ethical or a component of integrity to the action, where it becomes less of a choice in some ways and more of a calling of spirit. You know what I mean? Like not
absolutely
to have a cell phone.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you speak directly to it, because I'm looking at the table of contents in my book, and the next section, the story space is ready, is our inner environment, right? Because when we do those things to create space in our modern world and in our personal home environments for sacred story and for worthy story. You know, when we're up here visiting my mom, you know, my mom grew up in the 1930s. She has stories of what it was like in, you know, a blue-collar suburb in the 50s. She has stories of what it was like during World War II. I can never experience those things, but I can learn. You know, and we don't necessarily have to agree on every single thing, you know, with every person that we talk to, in order to appreciate and learn from and have the deep joy of their stories. And so, you know, that's part of what I think we have to do. Maybe we don't have to do, but it's our choice. I think there's a Rumi poem, go ahead, put this off as long as you can, you know, because you're just going to keep coming back, and it's the invitation is going to keep arriving on your plate. You know,
exactly.
Oh, you don't want to do that now. You want to go and, you know, you want to go and watch, watch the Talking Heads on the TV screen and watch the whatever, you know, television judge show that they'll have on in the afternoon.
Right.
Oh, you want to keep doing that? Go ahead.
see
where that gets you.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of that sacred, this is just a little story how a story influenced me.
Sure.
You won't be able to guess where I'm going to go with this, because I'm going to go with a made-for-TV movie from the 1970s. But I don't know if you remember Peter Falk, who played Columbo. And there was an actress, Jill Clayburgh, and the two of them did a film together called Griffin and Phoenix. And it came out in the 1970s. And in the film, there are two folks, maybe in their 30s or 40s. I think he's in his 40s, maybe she's in her 30s. And they both have a terminal illness, but neither one knows that the other one has the illness. And they just go and they do, you know, silly, absurd things, you know, sneaking in the back door of the theater, even though they have money to pay for tickets, or, you know, painting their names on the water tower. But other things like playing with a dog and, you know, flying a kite along the beach. And at some point, Clayburgh's character asked Peter Falk's character, what's something that you wanted to do when you were, when you were 14 years old, but you never did, right? And so they go ahead and they try these things. And the message of the story, I don't think Falk's character actually says it directly, but the message is, and I can't do a good Peter Falk accent, so I'll do a poor one. He says, he says something to the effect of, I'm 47 years old, but I only feel like I've been alive for the last 2 weeks. Why the hell didn't I figure this out when I was 14? Right. So he doesn't say that directly, but that's the message of the movie. Well, and they do mention this age. I think it was 14. I was a 14-year-old laying on my stomach in the living room, watching TV, and on this occasion, I'll say it was a good thing the TV was on. Because I haven't led some charmed life. I've gone through my down times. I can tell you about years that have been really, really struggles for me. But I've never gone more than a couple of weeks without the thought, this might be the last 2 weeks.
Right.
And so I want to interact with this world as if this might be it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this is the last 2 weeks, my kiddos will be able to say, yeah, Dad played, he was out in the backyard getting lightning bugs with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfect. Now, I hope I have, I just turned 50. I hope I'm somewhere near halftime in my lifespan in this manifestation. But, you know, the Tibetans have a great line, tomorrow, the next life, which comes first, nobody knows. And one of the
mm-hmm.
Tibetan teachers says, two words, remember dying. Remember
mm-hmm.
dying. And because when we remember dying, then we can be alive today. I came across a great line from Mother Teresa just yesterday. She says, we fear the future because we are wasting the today.
Oh, boy.
We fear the future
yeah.
because we are wasting the today. Right? So
yeah.
You know, this is it. You know, my one friend, she likes to say, this is not a dress rehearsal. This
yeah.
is it. And so I want to, what are the stories that I truly want to share? You know, and I, for your listeners out there, what are the stories that you truly wish to tell? What are the stories you want to hear? Who are the people in your lives? You know, most of us have had that experience where we're at the funeral and we say, my goodness, I wish I had more time to hear her stories. I wish I would have paid more attention when he told those stories. Guess what?
Yeah.
This is the time. This is it. And you know, we can't get all of the stories. It's impossible. But this is it. There's a lovely phrase within the storytelling community. Every time someone dies, we lose a library. A library.
Mm-hmm.
One of my meditations is in the book is entitled Alexandria is Burning. Because the library at Alexandria, where all these wonderful books were lost, Alexandria is always burning. And
right.
and so that's the invitation. That's, you know, that's part of my mission. And I think you're probably feeling it as I'm sharing this with you. That's Joseph Campbell has some great stuff to say in terms of different phases of life. And I, you know, having just turned 50, I feel like I'm at this phase in my life where I do want to continue sharing those stories. I love telling stories, whether it's to the kiddos or to adult groups, but it's also time for me to be talking to people about story and story in our lives and encouraging people to be the storytellers and story listeners that we are meant to be. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that when you're talking about the work of Joseph Campbell and the different developmental stages in our life, connecting with those stories, which are human universals that we all need to salve us and to heal us and to make us feel connected with each other, that it's so important for us to have a wide array of being able to hear other people's stories so that when we are in those difficult spaces in our life, we can realize that we're not alone, you know. And I think that when we do go through, like, the midlife passage or we go through stages in our life developmentally which are difficult to go through, sometimes stories can connect us, and stories from younger people, too, can connect us to something that we've kind of lost inside ourselves and allow us to slow down enough so that we can reconnect with the sacred experience. And then we're not afraid of death, you know, because with that quote that you were talking about, you know, about being afraid of death because we're not in the present, we're not in the present moment, and we're ignoring the present moment. I think that storying can help us to reconnect with things in ourselves, and it's so important.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's just, you know, a lot of this is about community. Right. I mean,
absolutely.
we need people around us. As you said, we learn from each other's stories. I mean, we, you know, my wife and I, we've been together for I don't know when we started dating, 17, 18 years ago. And it's actually, you know, this is very much like, yeah, I don't know, pop psychology or something, but there's a real truth to it. We'll get together and we have other friends who are couples, and you'll see them kind of, you know, being frustrated with each other or bickering over something, and it's, you know, and it's a little something. It's nothing big, right? When you see them do it, there's a certain humor in it. You know, when we do it, it's so serious, right? But when you see them do it, it's funny. And it's funny because what's happening is we're recognizing, oh, yeah, you know, we're human beings. We have our foibles. We're going to have these little, you know, tit-for-tat things. And that's part of the game. You know, that's part of what we're in. I think one of the best things for our relationship is to have other folks around in relationship and to see that. The same goes with parenting, right? I mean, you know, the same goes with friends, everything, you know, to have the kind of the fluidity and also, you know, a lot of what we talked about is very serious stuff. It's very real stuff, but for me, what's so important is the humor. One of the Tibetan teachers, he says, one of the words that he uses to describe meditation is spaciousness, to have spaciousness. Mm-hmm. And he speaks of real humor, not cutting humor, not a lot of that harsh humor that you may hear on the cable TV or whatever, but that humor that kind of opens up a space, you know. Mm-hmm. And he says real humor creates a space where there is none. It creates a space where there is none. And so what happens when we share our humorous stories, when we laugh together, when we're playing together? You know, we're creating the space together, right? We're creating sacred space. You know, so it's almost sacred space upon sacred space, right? So first, you know, let's create the environment so that we can tell stories to each other. And then in that laughter and in that humor, you'll see it. You know, I was watching my daughter a few weeks ago, my daughter who's 10, Edith Anna, and we were having a gathering. Actually, our eldest daughter, who's in her mid-20s, she was there, and one of her old friends from high school and even from childhood, he was there. He's an art student and was just graduating. And we were throwing, you know, family stories and stories of friends were bouncing around the dinner table, and we were all laughing. And Edie will sometimes be a little bit quiet when there's a larger group, but I looked and I saw her, and I was watching her watch everybody else, and she just had this great, like, glowing smile, listening and soaking in the stories. And what it reminded me of was and again, I don't want to overly idealize, because there was certainly negative stuff, and, you know, there was prejudice in my family and bigotry, just like most other families, but there was a lot of wonderful, great stuff too. And it reminded me of those moments when I would just be sitting there grinning, and these adults would be going back and forth and laughing together. I just had this thought, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, Jenny. I don't know if it made it into the book. It may have, it may not. I think it did. I guess it was a few weeks ago. I got it in one of the last chapters. But, you know, we'll watch a movie, and I like to watch a good film. But if you think of some of these movies, you know, my wife and I always watch the credits at the end, and you'll see how many hundreds of people were involved in the making of the film. And sometimes a film will have special effects and a multi-million dollar budget. And so these folks, you'll have hundreds of people working with a multi-million dollar budget, and they'll create something to give a story for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And that's great. But I submit that we could get together with some people that we love in our lives, whether they're family or friends or some combination, we get together, we can do that next weekend. And without hundreds of people, without 2 years' work, without a budget of millions, you can create something that will be as entertaining, probably more worthy, maybe more memorable, by just sitting there and being there together and sharing your stories. And it's like, wow, what amazing creatures we are.
Absolutely. Well, we've just got a very few minutes left, so I want to make sure that you're able to give your information about your websites and your next story work that you're doing and that sort of thing. So this would be the time to do that.
Okay, Jenny. Yeah, and as I say, you know, I do have a couple of websites, and I have a blog, and you could say a person who's talking about shutting down his computer, but I also one of my lines is, don't let a little bit of hypocrisy get in the way of a good idea. And I recognize that, you know, skillful means, as they'll say in Buddhism, that you do have to sometimes use things, and I do utilize things like that. So my one website, if you'd like to see, if people would like to see some of the work I do with children, is Michael the Storyteller. And my other website where I've shared some excerpts from the book, and I'll be putting more out on that, is lifeasartlifeasprayer.com. Lifeasartlifeasprayer.com. And there's ways of contacting us through that, where you could send us an email through those websites if you'd like more information on what I'm doing. And also we're taking a break for this summer, but we'll be starting up in the fall again our Buddhist Christian Mother Church, which at this point is a home church. We have over 100 people have come through. We usually have maybe 30 people or so. We do it on Sunday mornings a couple times a month, and it's open to all are welcome. So if anybody's interested in that, they could inquire about that as well. And again, it's about community. So thank you so much for inviting me to be on here, Jenny. It's been a pleasure, and I applaud what you're doing with this to invite people into the sacred through your work and through the conversations and interviews that you have with others.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks so much for sharing all your ideas, all your wisdom, and hopefully folks will listen to this and feel different about the life they're living, because I think we've covered a lot of ground and new ground and old ground, you know, like the ancestors. And thank you so much. Thank you so much for a rich hour.
Okay, and you take care, Jenny.
You too, Michael. Take good care. Bye.
Thank
now.
You. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening to Inner Voice Intuitive Hour tonight. Feel free to check out my website, innervoiceintuitive.com, and to sign up for my free ebook, Chakra Balancing for Every Body and Soul. I'll be sending out a newsletter about connecting with some of these topics having to do with the sacred. So get yourself on that list, and I will be sending you out that once a month here, and that's a great way to connect with Inner Voice. Thanks so much to Michael O'Malley for tonight's program. And whatever you do, guys, go and make magic, feel magic, create magic, indwell in magic, because that's really what we're here for. Have a great evening, everybody. Bye now.